She wanted to tell him that he was taking too much for granted, that she was still determined, that she couldn't come back, but all she said feebly was,
"What?"
"Ever since the frost started working out of the ground," Bo said, "I've been building a house."
"A house?"
She still had the feeling of idiocy, as if all she could say was senseless sounds, monosyllables, parrotings of his words. "A two-story, eight-room house. When I left, the foundation was in and the frame up. Full cement basement, four bedrooms upstairs, living room, dining room, kitchen, big front hall. I sold the two lots and kept the best one for us."
"But, Bo, I wrote you—"
They were outside the station. Bo raised his arm at a taxi, and it pulled up to the curb. The street was of cement, and when they got in and started riding, Elsa sat, marveling idiotically, at how smoothly they went, not a bump or a sway. She brushed her hand across her mouth, trying to get hold of herself, forget how things had started falling in her mind the instant she saw him. But his voice was in her ears, warm, reassuring, and his arm lay across the seat above her shoulders. "Look, honey," he said, "I started building the house in spite of your letter. We might have had a lot of hard luck, and what we did and said, me especially, might not be very pretty. But we're going to start all over, see? That's why I got the house going, just for a kind of guarantee."
"I don't know," she said. "I don't think—"
"I'll tell you something," Bo said, and pulled her around to face him. The taxi stopped in front of a hotel, but Bo paid no attention. "I'll tell you something. When I left Richmond, I thought I was leaving you for good. I thought I really was, after that night. You know how long it lasted? About 3 weeks. I've been so lonesome and sick for you I can't sleep. Then when I thought I had a good start, I came back for you, and you weren't there." He tightened his hold on her shoulders, and his eyes were so urgent that she wavered. "I just can't live without you," he said. "That sounds dippy, but it's true. And you can't live without me either, can you?" She did not answer. "Can you?" How do the kids feel about it?"
"I don't know. Kids forget so quick."
"Meaning you can't forget," he said. His hands loosened, and he sat back. The little thing like a clock went on ticking in the taxi. The driver was looking straight ahead, whistling through his teeth. "I'll tell you something else," Bo said. "I'll never let myself go like that again as long as I live. I got on top of all that when I found out how much I missed you."
"But how can you promise a thing like that?" she said. "You'll forget and lose your temper again, and there you'll be."
"All I can do is promise and mean it." Because she needed time to think, and because she didn't like talking in front of the driver, she opened the door. Bo paid the driver and led her into the hotel lobby. It was 1:30 by the clock over the desk. "How about dinner?"
"I ought to be getting back," she said, and for an instant, looking at his face with her own absurd words slowly making their meaning plain, she laughed.
"What did you bring the suitcase for, then?"
She looked at the bag. In it she had packed night clothes, a change of clothes, stockings, clean underwear. Her mouth was open and dry, and she swallowed. "I don't know," she said. In the middle of the lobby he burst into loud, triumphant laughter, the kind of full, deep-chested laughter he so seldom voiced.
"See," he said, "I told you didn't mean it. You're coming back with me tomorrow."
"Oh, no," she said. "No, I couldn't."
"Why not?"
There were a dozen reasons why not. She had been over them 100 times. But when she opened her mouth, her treacherous tongue betrayed her again. "Chester couldn't just leave school," she said. Bo motioned her toward the dining room, and she went as if sleepwalking. The waiter pulled out a chair for her, and she sat down in it, as if afraid it would collapse the way everything else had collapsed. Bo's eyes across the table were full of mirth, but warm, excited, loving, a look like those she remembered from years back, like the day they had become engaged, when they went walking in the snow and fell down in the middle of a field and sat laughing and kissing.
"You've got a nice mouth," she had told him then, "a nice mouth and dappled eyes."
"Ah, Bo," she said, smiling at him, unable to think of a single one of the things she had been so resolutely going to say.
"If you come in June," he said, "I can have the house all finished for you."
He reached for her hand across the table, and his face was twisted with a smile that looked as if it hurt him.
"Lordy," he said, "you don't know how much you had me scared."
"Is it really good up there?" she said curiously. "Do you really think we can make some kind of a home there?"
"Listen," he said, "Canada's in a war, and they're howling for more wheat, all the time. Homesteaders are already coming into that place by the hundreds. Know what I did? I homesteaded a quarter and preempted a quarter right next to it. That's a half section of wheat land, and wheat is going to be worth its weight in gold."
"But what about the railroad? I thought..."
"Oh, the railroad," Beau said. "That's died. Saving steel for war factories. The steel came into White Mud and stopped. But it's all right. We've got a start and a house and lot and a farm. Wait till wheat gets to be $3 a bushel, and we have 200 acres in and get 60 bushel to the acre."
In early June 1914, Elsa loaded the children into the train under the brown eaves of the station, said goodbye to Sarah and George and Kristen and Erling and her father, all attending her dutifully as they would have attended her funeral, shook hands with Henry Mossman, holding his fingers in one last relinquishment of what he stood for and had offered her, and set her feet on the iron steps. The boys were already climbing on the seat inside and sticking their tongues out against the glass. For the third time, and each time forever, each time certain she would never return, she left home to hazard herself and her hopes in a new and unknown country. "And, oh God," she said, looking through the windows at her family, Kristen with her handkerchief out, her father straight and grim with his hat formally off, Sarah placid with pursed mouth and hands folded across her stomach, "oh God, let it be final this time. Let the house Beau is building be the place we'll stay in the rest of our lives. Let it be the real home that the boys can look back to without a single regret." Because she knew she was surrendering completely this time. She knew that she would stick to Beau now, no matter what came. She had made her bed, and this time she would lie in it. The train jerked. She waved, and as they moved up the platform, she seized the window catches and shoved up the glass, and with her arm outside the window, waved once more, the last time, at the place that had been home. Part 4 Chapter 1 In the summer, it was the homestead, the little round-roofed shack that looked like a broad freight car with one side extended into a sleeping porch where the two beds were, the single room with the kerosene stove against one wall and the cupboards built up beside it, the table and the benches and the couch where the cat slept all day long, curled up dozing, but sleeping so lightly that a finger placed on one hair of him anywhere would bring him instantly awake with a prrt. The homestead was the open, flat plain, unbroken, clear to the horizon on every side except the south, where the Bearpaw Mountains, way down across the line in Montana, showed in a thin white line that later in summer turned to brown. In August, when the heat was intense, the mountains faded out of sight in the haze and heat waves, but almost any day in June and early July they could be seen, and they were an important part of the farm. There were other important things about the farm, the intimate parts like the pasture, a half-mile long and 200 yards wide, fenced with three tight strands of barbed wire on peeled cedar posts, the whole thing a pride to Bruce because there was no fence anywhere near as tight and neat on the other farms nearby. His father was a thorough man on a job. When he put in a fence, he put in a fence that he need not be ashamed of. He set the posts deep in the ground and tamped them in tight. He bought a wire stretcher and strung the strands like guitar strings. The pasture was cut diagonally by the coulee, and just below the house was the reservoir, and across the reservoir and through the fence was the long 60-acre wheat field, and the smaller field of flax, and the end of those fields was both the south line of their property and the international boundary. The farm was that feeling, too, the sense of straddling two nations, so that even though you were American, living in Canada, you lost nothing by it, but really gained, because the 4th of July was celebrated in Canada, and Canadian holidays like Victoria Day and the King's Birthday were celebrated in Montana, and you got in on both. And you lived in Saskatchewan, in one nation, but got your mail in Montana, in another. The farm was every summer between June and September. It was the long trip in the first year by wagon, but later by car, from White Mud out. It was the landmarks on that trail, the Frenchman's house with a dozen barefooted children streaking for the barn, the gates that had to be opened, the great horse ranch where they traveled hours without seeing a living thing except herds of horses as wild as coyotes. It was Robsart, a little clot of dwellings with a boarding house that they generally tried to make for the noon meal, and then scattered farms again along the grass-grown wagon track, and a couple of little streams to ford, and Gadke's, where they always stopped while Pa talked things over with Mr. Gadke, because Mr. Gadke was a smart dry farmer, until finally the last gate and the last ford just past the twin tar-papered shacks that all the homesteaders called Pete and Emil, and then their own house, and the familiar, unfamiliar look of the fence and fire guard and pasture, the first time in the spring. Farm was the shut-up, mousy smell of the house, the musty smell of packed quilts, the mattresses out in the sun on the first morning. It was the oil that had to be wiped off his gopher traps, and the first walk out along the pasture fence to the edge of the field with the traps over his shoulder. It was trouble with water sometimes when the well hole beside the reservoir had caved in, and they had to haul drinking water in barrels for 2 miles, and stories like the one his father told about the pickets down in Montana. The pickets had no well, only a little creek bed that often dried up on them, and then they hoarded water, according to Pa, like nothing you ever saw. A pan of water would be used to boil eggs in the morning, then the dishes would be washed in it, then all the family would wash, one after the other. Then the water would be strained to get the grease and dirt out, and saved to put in the radiator of the pickets' old car. Pa swore you could tell whether the pickets had had cabbage or beans or sweet corn for dinner just by smelling the boiling radiator of that old McLaughlin. Farm ordinarily was the things he and Chet did together. The guns they whittled out of sticks, the long campaigns in the coulee, and the patch of sweet corn when it got high enough to make good cover. It was the Russian thistle they hoed out of garden and fire guard, and the swearing his father did when the thistle got a good start in the wheat field. It was long days of blazing sun and violent rains, and once it was a cyclone that passed a mile south of them. That was when they were still living in the tent, before Pa got the house built, and Pa roped them all down in the section hole until he was sure the twister wasn't going to hit them. In this summer of 1918, because Chet was staying in town to be delivery boy for Mr. Babcock in the confectionery store, the homestead was isolation and loneliness, though he never felt it or knew it for what it was. Only when his mother looked at his father and said they should never have let Chet take that job, it left Brucey too much alone. Then he felt vaguely disturbed and faintly abused, but he never did really believe he was lonely, because he loved the homestead, and the Sunday school hymns he sang to himself down in the flowered coulee meant to him very definite and secret and precious things— meant primroses and space and the wet slap of a rare east wind, and those tunes would mean those things to him all his life. Still, he was almost always alone, and that summer he somehow lost his identity as a name. There was no other boy to confuse him with. He wasn't Bruce, but the boy, and because he was the only thing of his kind in all that summer world, he needed no name, but only his own sense of triumphant identity. He knew the homestead in intimate and secret detail because there was so little variety in it that the small things took the senses. He knew the way the grass grew curling over the lip of a burnout, and how the prairie owls nested under those grassy lips. He knew how the robins tucked their nests back under the fringes of the prairie wool, and their sky-blue eggs were always a wonder. He could tell by the way the horses clustered in a corner of the pasture when something was wrong, as when Dick got wound up in the lower strand of the fence and almost cut his leg off trying to break loose. He could tell instantly when a weasel was after the hens by the kind of clamor they made. Nothing else, for some reason, ever caused that fighting squawk from the mother hens. He could tell a badger's permanent burrow from the one he made in digging out a gopher. The yapping of coyotes on a moonlit night was lonely and beautiful to him, and the yard and chicken house and fire guard and coolie were as much a part of him as his own skin. He lived in his own world in summer, and only when hail or wind or gophers or Russian thistle threatened the wheat on which he knew his father yearly gambled everything, was there much communication with the adult world, whose interests were tied down to the bonanza farming and the crop. Wheat, he knew, was very high. The war did that. And he knew, too, that they were not well off, that every spring his father scraped together everything he had for seed and supplies, and hoped for a good year so that he could clean up. He knew that they had less than most of the homesteaders around. They didn't have a barn, a cow. They had two in town, but it was a hard trip to bring them out. A seeder, a binder, a disc, a harrow. They didn't have much of anything, actually, except a team, a plow, and a stone boat. Anything he didn't have tools for, his father either borrowed tools to do or hired done. But that frantic period of plowing and seeding came early, before his senses had adjusted themselves completely to the homestead. And later, in the period when they did practically nothing but sit and wait and hope that the weather would give them a crop, he moved in a tranced air of summer and loneliness and delight. At the end of the first week in this summer, he caught a weasel in one of his gopher traps, and brought it, still twisting and fighting in the trap, to the house. His father and mother came to the door. His mother made a face and shivered. "Oh," she said, "ugly, snaky thing." But his father showed more interest. "Got something special, huh?" he said. He came down and took the ringed chain from the boy's hand, held the weasel up. The weasel hissed in his face, trying to jump at him, and he straightened his arm to hold the swinging trap away. "You've got to hand it to them," he said. "There isn't anything alive with more fight in it."
"Take it and kill it," Elsa said. "Don't just keep it in the trap, torturing it."
Bruce was looking at his father. He ignored his mother's words because this was men's business. She didn't understand about weasels.
"Maybe I could keep him till he turns into an ermine," he said.
"Why not?" his father said. "You could get $3 for his pelt these days. We ought to be able to make a cage that'd hold him."
"Oh, Bo," Elsa said, "keep a weasel?"
"Give Boopus here something to do," Bo said. "You've been telling me we ought to get him a pet."
Bruce looked from one to the other, wondering when they had talked over getting him a pet.
"We've got old Tom now," he said.
"Old Tom," his father said, "is so full of mice his mind is all furry."
"We ought to get a dog," Elsa said, "not a vicious thing like a weasel."
"Well, we've got the weasel, and we don't know any place to get a dog."
Bo looked down at the boy and grinned. He swung the weasel gently back and forth, and it arched its long yellow body against the trap and lunged.
"Let's go make a cage for this tough guy," Bo said.
"Can I have a dog, too?"
"Maybe, if I can find one."
"Holy catartan," Bruce said. "A cat, a dog, and a weasel. Maybe I can catch some more and start a weasel farm."
"I'd move out," his mother said. She waved them away.
"Hurry up if you're going to keep that bloodthirsty thing. Don't leave it in the trap with its broken leg."
They made a cage out of a beer case, screened under the hinged top, and with a board removed at the bottom, leaving an opening over which they tacked a strip of screen. They had trouble getting the weasel out of the trap, and finally Bo had to smother him in a piece of horse blanket and spring the jaws loose and throw blanket and all in the cage. For 3 days the weasel sulked in the corner and would eat nothing. But when the boy said he didn't think it was going to live, his father laughed at him.
"You can't kill a weasel just by breaking his leg. Put a mouse in there and see what happens. Next day, the boy rescued a half-dead mouse that Tom was satedly toying with under the bed and dropped it in the cage. Nothing happened, but when he came back later, the mouse was dead, with a hole back of his ear and his body limp and apparently boneless. The boy fished the carcass out with a bent wire, and from then on there was no question of the weasel's dying. The problem was to find enough mice, but after a few days he tried a gopher, and then it was all right. There had been a wind during the night, and all the loneliness of the world had swept up out of the southwest. The boy had heard it wailing through the screens of the sleeping porch where he lay, and he had heard the washtub bang loose from the outside wall and roll on down the coulee, and the slam of the screen door, and his mother's padding feet as she rose to fasten things down. Through one half-open eye he had peered up from his pillow to see the moon skimming windily in a luminous sky. In his mind's eye he had seen the prairie outside with its woolly grass and cactus white under the moon, and the wind, whining across that endless oceanic land, sang in the screens, and sang him back to sleep. Now, after breakfast, when he set out through the pasture on the round of his traps, there was no more wind, but the air smelled somehow recently swept and dusted, as the house in town smelled after his mother's cleaning. The sun was gently warm on the bony shoulder blades of the boy, and he whistled, and whistling, turned to see if the bear paws were in sight to the south. There they were, a tenuous outline of white, just breaking over the bulge of the world. The mountains of the moon, the place of running streams and timber and cool heights that he had never seen, only dreamed of on days when the baked gumbo of the yard cracked in the heat and the sun brought cedar smells from fence posts long since split and dry and odorless, when he lay dreaming on the bed with a Sears Roebuck or a tea-eaten catalogue before him, picking out the presents he would buy for his mother and his father and Chet and his friends next Christmas or the Christmas after that. On those days he looked often and long at the snowy mountains to the south, while dreams rose in him like heat waves, blurring the reality of the unfinished shack and the bald prairie of his home. The bear paws were there now, and he watched them a moment, walking, his feet automatically dodging cactus clumps, before he turned his attention to the scattered stakes that marked his traps. He ran the line at a half-trot, whistling. At the first stake the chain was stretched tightly down the hole. The pull on its lower end had dug a little channel in the soft earth of the mound. Gently, so as not to break the gopher's leg off, the boy eased the trap out of the burrow, held the chain in his left hand, and loosened the stake with his right. The gopher tugged against the trap, but it made no noise. There were only two places where they made a noise, at a distance when they whistled a warning, and in the weasel's cage. Otherwise they kept still. For a moment he debated whether to keep this one alive for the weasel, or to wait so he wouldn't have to carry a live one all the way around. Deciding to wait, he held the chain out, measured the rodent, and swung. The knobbed end of the stake crushed the skull, and the eyes popped out of the head, round and blue. A trickle of blood started from nose and ears. The feet kicked. Releasing the gopher, the boy lifted it by the tail and snapped its tail fur off with a smart flip. Then he stowed the trophy carefully in the breast pocket of his overalls. For the last 2 years he had won the grand prize offered by the province to the schoolchild who destroyed the most gophers. On the mantel in town were 2 silver loving cups, and in the cigar box under his bed in the farmhouse were already 740 tails, the catch of 3 weeks. In one way he resented his father's distributing poison along the wheat field, because poisoned gophers generally got down their holes to die, and he didn't get the tails. So he spent most of his time trapping and snaring in the pasture, where poison could not be spread because of the horses. Picking up trap and stake, Bruce kicked the dead gopher down its burrow and scooped dirt over it with his toe. They stunk up the pasture if they weren't buried, and the bugs got into them. Frequently he had stood to windward of a dead and swollen gopher, watching the body shift and move with the movements of the beetles and crawling things in it. If such an infested corpse were turned over, the carrion beetles would roar out, great hard-shelled, orange-colored, scavenging things that made his blood curdle at the thought of their touching him. And after they were gone, and he looked again, he would see the little black ones, undisturbed, seething through the rotten flesh. So he always buried his dead now. Through the gardens of red and yellow cactus blooms he went, whistling, half-trotting, setting his traps afresh whenever a gopher shot upright, whistled, and ducked down its hole. All but two of the first 17 traps held gophers, and he came to the 18th confidently, expecting to take this one alive. But this gopher had gone in head first, and the boy put back in his pocket the salt sack he had brought along for a game bag. He would have to trap or snare one down by the dam. On the way back he stopped with bent head while he counted the morning's catch of tails, mentally adding this lot to the 740 he already had, trying to remember how many he and Chet had had this time last year. As he finished his mathematics, his whistle broke out again, and he galloped down through the pasture, running for very abundance of life, until he came to the chicken house just within the fire guard. Under the eaves of the chicken house, so close that the hens were constantly pecking up to its door, and then almost losing their wits with fright, was the weasel's cage. The boy lifted the hinged top and looked down through the screen.
"Hello," he said. "Hungry?"
The weasel crouched, its snaky body humped, its head thrust forward and its malevolent eyes steady and glittering.
"Tough, ain't you?" the boy said. "Just you wait, you blood-sucking old stinker, you. Won't I skin you quick, huh?"
There was no dislike or emotion in his tone. He took the weasel's malignant ferocity with the same indifference he displayed in his gopher-killing. Weasels, if you kept them long enough, were valuable. He would catch some more and have an ermine farm. He was the best gopher trapper in Saskatchewan. Why not weasels? Once, he and Chet had even caught a badger, though they hadn't been able to take him alive because he was caught by only three hind toes and lunged so savagely that they had to stand off and stone him to death in the trap. But weasels you could catch alive, and Pa said you couldn't hurt a weasel, short of killing him outright. This one, though virtually three-legged, was as lively and vicious as ever. Every morning now he had a live gopher for breakfast, in spite of Elsa's protests that it was cruel. She had argued and protested, but he had talked her down. When she said that the gopher didn't have a chance in the weasel's cage, he retorted that it didn't have a chance when the weasel came down the hole after it either. When she said that the real job he should devote himself to was destroying all the weasels, he replied that then the gophers would get so thick they would eat the wheat down to stubble. Finally she had given up, and the weasel continued to have his warm meals. For some time the boy stood watching his captive. Then he turned and went into the house, where he opened the oat box in the kitchen and took out a chunk of dried beef. From this he cut a thick slice with the butcher knife and went munching into the sleeping porch where his mother was making the beds.
"Where's that little double knot?" he said.
"That what?"
"That little wee trap I use for catching live ones for Lucifer?"
"Hanging out by the laundry bench, I think.
Are you going trapping again now?"
"Lucifer hasn't been fed yet."
"How about your reading?"
"I take the book along and read while I wait. I'm just going down by the dam."
"I can, not ein, son."
"I can," the boy said.
"I am most delighted to comply with your request of the 23rd inst,"
he grinned at his mother. He could always floor her with a quotation out of a letter or the Sears Roebuck catalog. With the trap swinging in his hand and under his arm, the book Narrative and Lyric Poems, edited by somebody or other, which his mother kept him reading all summer so that next year he could be at the head of his class again, the boy walked out into the growing heat. From the northwest the coulee angled down through the pasture, a shallow swale dammed just above the house to catch the spring runoff of snow water. Below the dam, watered by the slow seepage from above, The coulee bottom was a parterre of flowers, buttercups in broad sheets, wild sweet pea and stinkweed. On the slopes were evening primroses, pale pink and white and delicately fragrant, and on the flats above the yellow and red burgeoning of the cactus. Just under the slope of the coulee, a female gopher and three half-grown pups basked on their warm mound. The boy chased them squeaking down the hole and set the trap carefully, embedding it partially in the earth. Then he retired back up on the level, where he lay full length on his stomach, opened the book, shifted so that the glare of the sun across the pages was blocked by the shadow of his head and shoulders, and began to read. From time to time he looked up from the book to roll on his side and stare out across the coulee, across the barren plains, pimpled with gopher mounds and bitten with fire and haired with dusty woolly grass. Apparently as flat as a table, the land sloped imperceptibly to the south, so that nothing interfered with his view of the ghostly mountains, looking higher now as the heat increased. Between his eyes and that smoky outline 60 miles away, the heat waves rose writhing like fine wavy hair. He knew that in an hour Pankhurst's farm would lift above the swelling knoll to the west. Many times he had seen that phenomenon, had seen Jason Pankhurst watering the horses or working in the yard, when he knew that the whole farm was out of sight. It was heat waves that did it, his father said. The gophers below had been thoroughly scared, and for a long time nothing happened. Idly the boy read through his poetry lesson, dreamfully conscious of the hard ground under him, feeling the gouge of a rock under his stomach without making any effort to remove it. The sun was a hot caress between his shoulder blades, and on the bare flesh where his overalls pulled above his sneakers, it bit like a burning glass. Still he was comfortable, supremely relaxed and peaceful, lulled into a half-trance by the heat and the steamy flower smells and the mist of yellow from the buttercup coulee below him. And beyond the coulee was the dim profile of the bear paws, the mountains of the moon. The boy's eyes, pulled out of focus by his tranced state, fixed on the page before him. Here was a poem, he knew. But it wasn't a poem, it was a song. His mother sang it often, working at the sewing machine in winter. It struck him as odd that a poem should also be a song, and because he found it hard to read without bringing in the tune, he lay quietly in the full glare of the sun, singing the page softly to himself. As he sang, the trance grew on him again. He lost himself entirely. The bright, hard, dividing lines between senses blurred, and buttercups, smell of primrose, feel of hard gravel under body and elbows, sight of the ghosts of mountains haunting the southern horizon, were one intensely felt experience focused by the song the book had evoked. And the song was the loveliest thing he had ever heard. He felt the words, tasted them, breathed upon them with all the ardor of his captivated senses. The splendor falls on castle walls and snowy summits old in story. The current of his imagination flowed southward over the shoulder of the world to the ghostly outline of the mountains of the moon, haunting the heat-distorted horizon. Oh, hark! Oh, hear how thin and clear and thinner, clearer, farther going! Oh, sweet and far, from cliff and scar! In the enchanted forest of his mind, the horns of Elfland blew, and his breath was held in the cadence of their dying. The weight of the sun had been lifted from his back. The empty prairie of his home was castled and pillared with the magnificence of his imagining, and the sound of horns died thinly in the direction of the mountains of the moon. From the coulee below came the sudden metallic clash of the trap, and an explosion of frantic squeals smothered almost instantly in the burrow. The boy leaped up, thrusting the book into the wide pocket of his overalls, and ran to the mound. The chain, stretched down the hole, jerked convulsively, and when he took hold of it he felt the life on the other end trying to escape. Tugging gently, he forced loose the digging claws and hauled the squirming gopher from the hole. On the way up to the chicken house, the dangling gopher, with a tremendous muscular effort, convulsed itself upward from the broken and imprisoned leg and bit with a rasp of teeth on the iron. Its eyes, the boy noticed impersonally, were shiny black, like the head of a hatpin. He thought it odd that when they popped out of the head after a blow, they were blue. At the cage, he lifted the cover and peered down through the screen. The weasel, scenting blood, backed against the far wall of the box, yellow body tense as a spring, teeth showing in a tiny, soundless snarl. Undoing the wire door with his left hand, the boy held the trap over the hole. Then he bore down with all his strength on the spring, releasing the gopher, which dropped on the straw and scurried into the corner opposite its enemy. The weasel's three good feet gathered under it, and it circled very slowly along the wall, its lips still lifted to expose the soundless snarl. The abject gopher crowded against the boards, turned once and tried to scramble up the side, fell back on its broken leg, and whirled like lightning to face its executioner again. The weasel moved carefully, circling, its cold eyes hypnotically steady. Then the gopher screamed, a wild, agonized, despairing squeal that made the boy swallow and wet his lips. Another scream, wilder than the first, and before the sound had ended, the weasel struck. There was a fierce flurry in the straw before the killer got its hold just back of the gopher's right ear, and then there was only the weasel looking at him over the dead and quivering body. In a few minutes, the boy knew, the gopher's carcass would be as limp as an empty skin, with all its blood sucked out and a hole as big as the ends of his two thumbs where the weasel had dined. Still he remained staring through the screen top of the cage, face wrapped and body completely lost. After a few minutes he went into the sleeping porch, stretched out on the bed, opened the Sears Roebuck catalog, and dived so deeply into its fascinating pictures and legends that his mother had to shake him to make him hear her call to lunch. Chapter 2 Things greened beautifully that June. Rains came up out of the southeast, piling up solidly, moving toward them as slowly and surely as the sun moved, and it was fun to watch them come, the three of them standing in the doorway. When they saw the land east of them darken under the rain, Beau would say, "Well, it doesn't look as if it's going to miss us," and they would jump to shut windows and bring things in from yard or clothesline. Then they could stand quietly in the door and watch the good rain come, the front of it like a wall, and the wind ahead of it stirring up dust until it reached them and drenched the bare, packed earth of the yard, and the ground smoked under its feet and darkened and ran with little streams, and they heard the swish of the rain on roof and ground and in the air. They always watched it a good while, because rain was life in that country. When it didn't stop after 20 minutes or a half hour, Beau would say with satisfaction, "She's a good soaker. That'll get down to the roots. Not so heavy it'll all run off, either." Then they would drift away from the door, because it was sure to be a good rain, and there was another kind of satisfaction to be gained from little putter jobs, while the rain outside made a crop for you. Elsa would carry her plants outside, the wandering Jew and the foliage plants and the geraniums stalky like miniature trees, and set them in the rain. During that whole month there was much rain, and the boy's father whistled and hummed and sang. The boy lay in bed many mornings and heard him singing while he fried the bacon for breakfast. He always fried the bacon. He swore no woman knew how to do anything but burn it. And these days he always sang, fool songs he had learned somewhere back in the remote and unvisualizable past, when he had worked on the railroad, or played ball, or cut timber in Wisconsin. "Oh, I was a bouncing baby boy, the neighbors did allow. The girls, they hugged and kissed me then. Why don't they do it now?" He had a deep, big-chested voice, and he sang softly at first, rattling the pans, or whistled between his teeth with concentrated pauses between sounds, so that from the bed you knew he was slicing bacon off the slab.
Then a match would scrape on the tin front of the stove, and he would be singing again. "Monkey married the baboon's sister, smacked his lips, and then he kissed her. Kissed so hard he raised a blister." You lay in bed and waited, feeling fine because it had rained yesterday, but today was fair, a good growing day, and you could almost feel how the wheat would be pushing up through the warm and steaming earth. And in the other room your father sang, in great good humor, "She's thin as a broomstick, she carried no meat, she never was known to put soap on her cheek, her hair is like rope and the color of brass, but oh, how I love her, this dear little lass! Dear Evelina, sweet Evelina!" After a minute or two he would poke his head into the porch and frown blackly, turn his head and frown even more blackly at the other bed where your mother lay stretching and smiling. "I plow deep while sluggards sleep," he would say sepulchrally, and vanish. Then the final act, the great beating on the dishpan with a pewter spoon and his sing-song hog-calling voice, "Come and get it, you potluckers, or I'll throw it away." It was fun to be alive and awake and wait for your father to go through his whole elaborate ritual. It was fun to get up and souse in the wash basin outside the door and throw the soapy water on the packed earth and come in and eat while Pa joked at you, saying he thought sure you were dead. He had been in there 5 times, pinching and slapping like a Pullman porter, but no sign of life. "You sure do sleep heavy," he would say. "It's a wonder you don't break down the bed. I better put some extra slats in there." You joked back at him, and after breakfast you had a sparring match that left your ears all red and tingling, and then Pa went out to harrow to keep the earth broken up and the moisture in, and you went around your traps. All through June there were good mornings, but the best of them all was the day Bo went down to Cree for the mail, and when he came back there was a dog sitting in the car seat beside him. A big-footed, lappy-tongued, frolicsome pup with one brown and one white eye and a heavy golden coat. The boy played with him for an hour, rolling him over and pulling his clumsy feet out from under him. Finally he lay down on the ground, and the pup attacked his ears, sticking a red tongue into them, diving for openings, snuffling and snorting and romping. When the boy sat up, his mother and father were standing with their arms around one another, watching him. He went up very seriously and hugged them both in thanks for the pup. "You'll have to teach him tricks," his father said. "A dog's no good unless you educate him. He gets the habit of minding you that way."
"How'll I do it?"
"Show you tonight." His father reached out and cuffed him on the ear and grinned. "Anything you can think of you'd like to do next week?" The boy stared, wondering.
"What?
What? What?" his father said, mimicking him. "Can't you think of anything you'd like to do?"
"I'd like to drive the stone boat next time you use it."
"I don't think you know what fun is," his father said. "Don't you know what date it is?"
"Sure, it's June 27th. No, June 28th.
"Sure, and what comes after the week of June 28th? The boy wondered, looking at first one, then another. They were both laughing at him. Then it hit him.
"Fourth of July," he said.
"Okay," his father said. He cuffed at him again, but missed. "Maybe we'll go into Chinook for the fourth. Fireworks, ball game, parade, pink lemonade sold in the shade by an old maid."
"Whee," the boy said.
He stooped and wrestled the pup, and afterward, when he lay panting on the ground, resting, and the pup gave up lapping his ears and lay down too, he thought that he had the swellest ma and pa there was. That night his father showed him how to get the pup in a corner and make him sit up, bracing his back against the wall. For long, patient hours in the next few days he braced the pup there and repeated, "Sit up! Sit up! Sit up!" while he shoved back the slipping hind feet, straightened the limp spine, lifted the dropping front paws. You had to say the command a lot, his father said. And you had to reward him when he did it right, and you had to do only one trick at a time. After he learned to sit up, you could teach him to jump over a stick, roll over, speak, shake hands, and play dead. The word for playing dead was charge. He would teach him, Bruce thought, to do that next, so they could play war. It would be better than having Chet there, because Chet never would play dead. He always argued and said he shot you first.
When he wasn't training the pup, he was dreaming of Chinook and the ball game and parade and fireworks, skyrockets, Roman candles, pinwheels. He was curious about pinwheels because he remembered a passage in Peck's Bad Boy and His Pa, where a pinwheel took after Pa and cornered him up on the sofa. But he was curious about all fireworks. He had never seen any except firecrackers. And the finest thing of all to imagine was the mountains, because Pa and Ma decided that since they were that close, they might as well drive up to the mountains, too, and take the whole day. His father teased him. Probably, he said, it would rain pitchforks on the 4th. But his mother said, "Oh, Pa, don't talk like that." Then on the afternoon of the 3rd, they all stood in the yard and watched the southeast. Thunderheads were piling up there, livid white in front and black and ominous behind. Thunder rumbled like a wagon over a bridge. "It'll pass over," Elsa said, and patted Bruce on the back. "It just wouldn't be fair if it rained now and spoiled our holiday." The boy looked up and saw his father's dubious expression. "Do you think it'll blow over, Pa? Hardly any have blown over yet."
"Bound to blow over," his father said. "Law of averages. They can't all make rain."
But the boy remembered 3 rains from that same quarter, that same month, that had gone on for 24 hours. He stayed in the yard watching, hoping against hope, until the wall of dark was almost to the fire guard, and the advance wind was stirring dust in the yard, stayed until the first large drops fell and puffed heavily in the dust, stayed until his mother pulled him inside with dark speckles all over his shirt.
"Don't you worry," she said. "It'll be clear tomorrow. It has to be."
That night he stayed up until 9, waiting to see if the steady downpour would stop, hating the whisper of rain outside and the gravelly patter on the roof. The tomcat awoke and stretched on the couch, jumped off with a sudden soft thud, and went prowling into the sleeping porch. But the boy sat up. His parents were reading, not saying much. Once or twice he caught them looking at him, and always the house whispered with the steady, windy sound of the rain. This was no thunder shower. This was a drencher, and it could go on for 2 days this time of year. His father had said so with satisfaction of other rains just like it. When his mother finally sent him off to bed, he went unwillingly, undressed slowly to see if the rain wouldn't stop before he got his shoes off, his stockings off, his overalls off. But when he was in his nightshirt, it still rained steadily and insistently, and he turned into his pillow, wanting to cry. A big tear came out, and he felt it hanging on the side of his nose. He lay very still for fear it would fall off. He strangled the sob that jumped in his throat, because that would make the drop fall. And while he was balancing the drop, he fell asleep. After the night's rain, the yard was spongy and soft under the boy's bare feet. He stood at the edge of the packed dooryard in the flat thrust of sunrise, looking at the ground washed clean and smooth and trackless, feeling the cool mud under his toes. Experimentally, he lifted his right foot and put it down in a new place, pressed, picked it up again to look at the neat imprint of straight edge and curving instep and the 5 round dots of toes. The air was so fresh that he sniffed as he would have sniffed the smell of cinnamon. Lifting his head, he saw how the prairie beyond the fire guard looked darker than in dry times, healthier with green-brown tints, smaller and more intimate somehow than it did when the heat waves crawled over scorched grass and carried the horizons backward into dim and unseeable distances. And standing in the yard above his one clean footprint, feeling his own verticality in all that spread of horizontal land, he sensed that as the prairie shrank, he grew. He was immense. A little jump would crack his head on the sky. A stride would take him to any horizon. His eyes turned into the low south sky, cloudless, almost colorless, in the strong light. Just above the brown line of the horizon, faint as a watermark on pale blue paper, was the tracery of the mountains, tenuous and far off, but today accessible for the first time. His mind had played among those ghostly summits for uncountable lost hours. Today, in a few strides, they were his. And more, Under the shadow of those peaks, those bear paws that he and his mother always called the Mountains of the Moon, was Chinook, the band, the lemonade stands, the parade, the ball game, the fireworks. The pup lay watching, belly down on the damp ground. In a gleeful spasm, the boy stooped to flap the dog's ears, then bent and spun in a wild war dance while the pup barked. And when his father came to the door in his undershirt, yawning, running a hand up the back of his head and through his hair, peering out from gummed eyes to see how the weather looked, the boy's voice was one deep, breathing relief from yesterday's rainy fear. "It's clear as a bell," he said. His father yawned again, clopped his jaws, rubbed his eyes, mumbled something from a mouth furry with sleep. He stood on the step, scratching himself comfortably, looking down at boy and dog.
"Going to be hot," he said slyly. "Might be too hot to drive."
"Oh, Pa!
Going to be a scorcher. Melt you right down to axle grease riding in that car."
The boy regarded him doubtfully, saw the lurking, sly droop of his mouth.
"Ah, we are too going!"
At his father's laugh, he burst from his immobility like a sprinter starting, raced one complete circle around the house with the dog after him. When he flew around past his father again, his voice trailed out behind him at the corner.
"Gonna feed the hens," he said.
His father looked after him, scratched his knee, laughed suddenly, and went back indoors. Through chores and breakfast, the boy moved with the dream of a day's rapture in his eyes, but that did not keep him from swift and agile helpfulness. He didn't even wait for commands. He scrubbed himself twice, slicked down his hair, hunted up clean clothes, wiped the mud from his shoes, and put them on. While his mother packed the shoebox of lunch, he stood at her elbow, proffering aid. He flew to stow things in the topless old Ford. He got a rag and polished the brass radiator. Once or twice, jumping around to help, he looked up to see his parents looking at each other with the knowing, smiling expression in the eyes that said they were calling each other's attention to him.
"Just like a racehorse," his father said, and the boy felt foolish, swaggered, twisted his mouth down, said, "Aw."
But in a moment he was hustling them again. They ought to get going, with 50 miles to drive. Long before they were ready, he was standing beside the Ford, licked and immaculate, and so excited that his feet jumped him up and down without his own volition or knowledge. It was 8 o'clock before his father came out, lifted off the front seat, poked the flat stick down into the gas tank, and pulled it out, dripping.
"Pretty near full," he said. "If we're going to the mountains, too, we better take a can along, though. Fill that 2-gallon one with the spout."
The boy ran, dug the can out of the shed, filled it at the spigot of the drum that stood on a plank support to the north of the house. When he came back, his left arm stuck straight out and the can knocking against his leg, his mother was settling herself into the back seat among parcels and water bags.
"Goodness," she said, "this is the first time I've been the first ready since I don't know when. I should think you'd have all done this last night."
"Plenty time," the father stood looking down at the boy. "All right, racehorse, you want to go to this shindig, you better hop in."
The boy was up in the front seat like a squirrel. His father walked around to the front of the car.
"Okay," he said, "look sharp now. When she kicks over, switch her to magneto and pull the spark down."
The boy said nothing. He looked upon the car with respect and a little awe. They didn't use it much, and starting it was a ritual like a fire drill. The father unscrewed the 4-eared brass plug, looked down into the radiator, screwed the cap back on, and bent to take hold of the crank.
"Watch it now," he said.
The boy felt the gentle heave of the springs up and down as his father wound the crank. He heard the gentle hiss in the bowels of the engine as the choke wire was pulled out, and his nose filled with the strong, volatile odor of gasoline. Over the slope of the radiator, his father's brown, strained face looked up.
"Is she turned on all right?"
"Yep, she's on battery."
"Must have flooded her. Have to let her rest a minute."
They waited, and then after a few minutes, the wave-like heaving of the springs again, the rise and fall of the blue shirt and bent head over the radiator, the sighing swish of the choke, a stronger smell of gasoline. The motor had not even coughed. The two voices came simultaneously from the car.
"What's the matter with it?"
His brow puckered in an intense scowl. Beau stood back, blowing mighty breaths.
"Son of a gun," he said.
Coming round, he pulled at the switch, adjusted the spark and gas levers. A fine mist of sweat made his face shine like dark oiled leather.
"There isn't anything really wrong, is there?"
Elsa said, and her voice wavered uncertainly on the edge of fear.
"I don't see how there could be," Beau said. "She's always started right off, and she was running all right when I drove her in here."
The boy looked at his mother sitting erect and stiff among the things on the seat. She was all dressed up, a flowered dress, a hat with hard green varnished grapes on it pinned to her red hair. For a moment she sat, stiff and nervous.
"What will you have to do?" she said.
"I don't know. Look at the motor."
"Well, I guess I'll get out of the sun while you do it," she said, and fumbled her way out of the clutter. The boy felt her exodus like a surrender, a betrayal. If they didn't hurry up, they'd miss the parade. In one motion, he bounced out of the car.
"Gee whiz," he said. "Let's do something. We gotta get started."
"Keep your shirt on," his father grunted.
Lifting the hood, he bent his head inside. His hand went out to test wires, wiggle spark plug connections, make tentative pulls at the choke. The weakly hinged hood slipped and came down across his wrist, and he swore.
"Get me the pliers," he said.
For 10 minutes he probed and monkeyed. "Might be the plugs," he said at last. "She doesn't seem to be getting any fire through her." Elsa, sitting on a box in the shade, smoothed her flowered dress nervously.
"Will it take long?"
"Half hour."
"Any day but this," she said. "I don't see why you didn't make sure last night."
Beau breathed through his nose and bent into the engine again. "It was raining last night," he said. One by one, the plugs came out, were squinted at, scraped, the gap tested with a thin dime. The boy stood on one foot, then the other, time pouring like a flood of uncatchable silver dollars through his hands. He kept looking at the sun, estimating how much time there was left. If they got started right away, they might still make it for the parade, but it would be close. Maybe they'd drive right up the street while the parade was on and be part of it.
"Is she ready?"
he said.
"Pretty quick."
He wandered over by his mother, and she reached out to put an arm around him.
"Well, anyway, we can get there for the band and the ball game and the fireworks," he said. "If she doesn't start till noon, we can make it for those."
She said, "Pa'll get it going in a minute. We won't miss anything, hardly."
"You ever seen skyrockets, Ma?"
"Once."
"Are they fun?"
"Wonderful," she said.
"Just like a million stars, all colors, all exploding at once."
His feet took him back to his father, who straightened up with a belligerent grunt.
"Now," he said, "if the sucker doesn't start now."
And once more the heaving of the springs, the groaning of the turning engine, the hiss of the choke. He tried short, sharp, half turns as if to catch the motor off guard. Then he went back to the stubborn, laboring spin. The back of his shirt was stained darkly, the curving dikes of muscles along the spines hollow, showing cleanly where the cloth stuck. Over and over, heaving, stubborn at first, then furious, till he staggered back, panting.
"God damn," he said. "What you suppose is the matter with the thing?"
"She didn't even cough once," the boy said,
and staring up at his father's face full of angry bafflement, he felt the cold fear touch him. What if it wouldn't start at all? What if, all ready to go, they had to unload the Ford and not even get out of the yard? His mother came over, and they stood close together, looking at the car and avoiding each other's eyes.
"Maybe something got wet last night," she said.
"Well, it's had plenty of time to dry out," Beau said.
"Isn't there something else you can try?"
"We can jack up the hind wheel, I guess, but there's no damn reason why we should have to."
"Well, if you have to, you'll have to," she said briskly. "After planning it for a week, we can't just get stuck like this, can we, son?"
Bruce's answer was mechanical, his eyes steady on his father.
"Sure not," he said.
His father opened his mouth to say something, looked hard at the boy, and shut his lips again. Without a word, he pulled out the seat and got the jack. The sun climbed steadily while he jacked up one hind wheel and blocked